I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We link writers to the places in which they set their stories, as if they themselves breathe life into that place, the American South of Flannery O'Connor, Charles Dickens' London, Langston Hughes' Harlem. Cape Breton Island, at the northeast tip of Nova Scotia, belongs to Alistair MacLeod, as if that wild island could be tamed by words. In MacLeod's stories, the island becomes a character. Children playing on the cliffs cannot avoid its overpowering ocean wind. There's so much sand driven into the trees that, in MacLeod's words, when the saw passed through them in the early darkness of the fall and winter evening, streaks of blue and orange flame shot from them. Men work themselves to death in the deep dark of the coal mines. In deliciously stark prose, MacLeod describes the island in all its weather-beaten moods. The capriciousness of sea ice in winter shapes the fate of families across the water. The graves of Scottish ancestors seem to hold up the cliffs. MacLeod's characters yearn to leave, but cannot stand to go. Connection listeners, we are talking this hour with Alistair MacLeod about the literary landscape of Cape Breton Island and beyond. We'd like you to join in the conversation. How does sense of place itself become a character in literature? The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join us online at theconnection.org. A couple of weeks back, Alistair MacLeod was in Dublin Castle to receive the world's richest literary award, the International Impact Literary Award, for his novel No Great Mischief. It was described by a panel of judges as a work by a master literary craftsman. I'm joined now by that craftsman, Alistair MacLeod. He's in a studio in Windsor, Ontario. Hello.
Hello.
Congratulations on your award.
Thank you very much.
You are, Mr. MacLeod, a man of some reserve, and yet I have spies that tell me you and your family indulged in a little jig in that castle when you got the award.
Well, no matter how reserved one is, there's spontaneity that lurks deep within. So I think that was one of the moments when the spontaneity came to the surface.
In your novel, No Great Mischief, you write about, I think it's the narrator's sister on a trip to Scotland who meets a woman on a beach who says, "You're from here. You've just been away for a while." Correct me if I've got my words wrong. But I was curious to know when I read that, if when you go to Ireland or to Scotland, you get the same kind of reaction from people there, or even in your own mind, if you see the connection between the land that your ancestors came from in Cape Breton Island.
Well, I think one of the things that happens to a people if they are in the same landscape for a long time and, you know, they interact with the landscape, but they also interact with themselves. And I think that, you know, people intermarry with one another over a long number of years and so on. And there are all kinds of cliches, you know, where people say, well, he looks Scandinavian or he looks Italian or he has red hair or he looks Irish or something like that. And I wouldn't, you know, take any of these observations to court or anything like that. But there is a certain kind of genetic recognition, I think, that exists among a great many people.
Do you think that it is a connection which goes beyond the cliches, if we're talking in point of fact about the Scottish heritage that seems to infuse the land of Cape Breton Island?
Well, I think that a lot of the people that came to Cape Breton Island came from, you know, certain islands, perhaps in Scotland, and they settled in family groups, and a lot of people came from those islands, and a lot of people remained. And so I think when you go back to, you know, the island of Barra or a place like that, if your ancestors came from Barra, you see probably a whole lot of your distant cousins who remain there. And I think in that way, you know, you're recognizing certain characteristics, and you're recognizing characteristics that perhaps have to do with island people.
Will be listened to by people who have not been to Cape Breton Island, though I think that number is getting smaller and smaller. When I ask you to describe the place where you spend your summers, do you have to think carefully about it, or can you give me a little geographical overview?
Well, Cape Breton is, as you said earlier, the northeastern part of Canada. It juts out into the ocean. It's up above Boston, farther out to sea than Boston. And it's kind of on the edge of North America, you know, looking towards Europe. And a lot of the people who settled there from the Highlands and Islands of Scotland were kind of on the edge of Europe, so they kind of traded the edge of Europe for the edge of North America in crossing the ocean. So you can, in imagination's mist, I suppose, look across the ocean from either side and imagine that you can see people on the other side. So these are people that were were coastal people and still are coastal people. So it's not like, you know, the center of the United States or the center of Canada where, you know, the landscape is that of the prairies or anything of that nature. It's quite a harsh landscape in terms of, you know, it's quite mountainous and forested and so on and lots of cliffs. But it's also very, very beautiful.
A real similarity to the land that those same people left, I suppose.
Yes, I think there are certain similarities. Yes, although when I think they left, I don't think they were saying,
you
know, oh boy, we're going to a place just like the one that we love.
Let's find a rotten little hard scrabble piece of land to make a life.
I don't think this was what was in their minds.
I want to ask you to read, if I can, a little bit from the novel No Great Mischief. Do you have the part at hand where the children are up on the cliff?
Yeah.
Could you read that to us? This is Alistair MacLeod reading from No Great Mischief.
If we were there in the windy days of fall, and if the wind were off the sea, we would run down to the Kalamrua's point and engage in contests to see who could remain standing in the wind's force along us. If we faced the sea, the wind would blow our breath back within us as the spray from the water on the rocks rose and covered us and Kalamrua's gravestone with glistening drops, and we would have to avert our heads and gasp for air or throw ourselves on our stomachs and breathe with our mouths pressed against the flattened grass or the cranberry vines or the creeping tendrils of wet moss. If the wind were off the land, we would not be allowed to go for fear that a sudden gust might lift and carry us over the point and dash us down to the shining boulders or out to fall into the wind-whipped sea, which was always brown and angry in its state of agitation. After such storms, the face of the cliff would be changed, although ever so slightly. Bits of rock would have fallen because of the waves pounding, and small sections of the seams of clay and shale would also have been washed into the sea. Only the hardest promontories of pure stone seemed to remain constant, but if one looked closely, one could see changes in them also, a new smoothness born of a new wearing, or small pockmarks on new surfaces where previously there were none. The cliff was moving inland, slowly but steadily, while Kalamrua's grave seemed to be moving out towards its edge.
That's the voice of Alistair MacLeod reading from his novel No Great Mischief, winner this year of the Impact Literary Award in Dublin. Our telephone number here at The Connection is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Give us a call if you'd like to talk with Alistair MacLeod or contribute to the conversation we're having about his writing. Now, you've not been back to Cape Breton Island since you collected this fancy award in Dublin Castle, have you?
That's correct. I have not been, but I have planned to be there in 2 days' time, or 2 or 3 days' time.
Are you driving from Windsor?
No, I'm driving from Windsor, yes.
And I'm curious to know whether or not you have any second thoughts about each trip back to Cape Breton Island, because for the past few years, each time you've gone back, you've carried another plaque or another trophy of your writing success with you. And one of the themes that is recurring in your writing is that the people who go away from Cape Breton Island and then come back a little fancier or a little better married or a little wealthier, driving a car without mud on it, are somehow not so welcome.
Oh, I don't know if that's really so. I hope that they'll welcome me. I still have my old car and I still have mud on it, so that'll be consistent. I think that one of the things that happens is there's a tension perhaps between people who wish to stay there, you know, have kind of a yearning in their hearts and then have a deep emotional attachment to that landscape and to the people. And then I wouldn't say opposed to that, but thrusting against that, I suppose, is, you know, the economic reality and the need to perhaps, you know, become educated or to further one's career. And I think that this is a tension that perhaps does not exist in big cities. You know, if you live in Boston or New York or Toronto and you wish to be a radio announcer or something like that, you can just, you know, take the course and ride on the subway and learn how to, you know, how to master your profession. But if you live far away in the north or in the east or in rural areas, you very often have to leave those whom you love, and you have to have, you know, $5,000 in a little bag or something like that. And I think there is a tension between an intellectual push and an emotional pull, and I think that a great many people experience this.
Which is why we so often watch the characters in your stories and your novels upon their return, because that seems to be something that most people do, that they don't go away and stay away.
No. Well, I think of Cape Breton more or less the way one might might think of one's mother, you know. you may go away from your mother and so on, but she will always be your mother with all that that entails.
Now, you spend every summer there now, is that right?
That's correct.
And you're pulling back on your teaching responsibilities at the University of Windsor. Does that mean that you'll be stuffing moss between the cracks of the clapboard to get the house ready for winter as well? Or?
Maybe. I don't think this winter, but maybe in winters to come.
Because that's the part of Cape Breton Island which always appears quite inhospitable. The cold and the wind and the sea ice are the things that take on characteristics in the book that are quite unfriendly to your human characters.
Yeah, well, I think if you're living in a rural landscape, you have to be, you know, ready for winter. And I think that this is something that's probably true, more or less, you know, for all Canadians, almost anywhere in Canada, you know, on February 13th, if you're outside without shelter, you'll freeze to death, you know. There are whole areas in the southern United States where you won't freeze to death, but other things may get you. So I think this is just a kind of description of a kind of landscape, and if you're going to live in a certain landscape, you better be ready, and you better be prepared, and you better know the landscape which you inhabit.
And when you cross that causeway onto Cape Breton Island, you have that same thrill that your characters describe as well?
I have some of the same thrills that some of the characters experience. Yeah.
And if you want to know what we're chuckling about, you can read the book and you'll get the insight on that. Our telephone number here at The Connection is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My guest is the writer Alistair MacLeod. We're discussing his books. If you'd like to join in the conversation, we'd love to have you join us. My name is Dick Gordon. This is The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University.
Hello, my name is Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, if you would like to join in the connection with the Canadian writer Alistair MacLeod. Mr. MacLeod, I wonder if we could start this little bit with another reading of yours. This from one of your short stories, The Vastness of the Dark. Have you got that at your left or right elbow?
Yes, I do.
And this is, I should let our listeners know, from a collection, re-release now in a collection of short stories, which is available in hardcover, called Island. Before you begin, what do we need to know about the little part that we're going to be hearing?
this is an excerpt from a story about a young man who wants to leave the home village that has formed his past, and he's sort of tired of it, and he wants to embark upon a new life. And towards the end of the story, he finds that leaving is not as simple as just physical removal. It's sort of a story about cliché to a certain extent, you know, the way we think that everybody who lives in mining towns is a certain way, or everybody who lives in fishing villages is a certain way, and so on. So this is a description of him on his birthday when he is a young man. But after today, I will probably not have to think about it anymore. For today I leave behind this grimy Cape Breton coal mining town whose prisoner I have been all of my life. And I have decided that almost any place must be better than this one, with its worn-out mines and smoke-black houses, and the feeling has been building within me for the last few years. It seems to have come almost with the first waves of sexual desire, and with it to have grown stronger and stronger with the passing months and years. For I must not now become as my father, whom I now hear banging the stove lids below me, as if there were some desperate rush about it all, and some place that he must be in a very short time, only to go nowhere. And I must not be as my grandfather, who is now an almost senile old man, nearing 90, who sits by the window all day, saying his prayers, and who in his moments of clarity remembers mostly his conquests over coal, and recounts tales of how straight were the timbers he and my father erected in the now caved-in underground drifts of 25 years ago, when he was 62, and my father 25, and I not yet conceived. It is a long, long time since my grandfather has worked, and all the big mines he worked in, and which he so romanticizes now, are closed. And my father has not worked since early March, and his presence in a house where he does not want to be breeds a tension in us all that is heightened now since school is closed and we are all home and forced in upon ourselves. And as he moves about on this morning, bangs stove's lids, pretending it is important that he does so, that he is wanted somewhere soon, and therefore must make this noisy rush, I feel myself separated from him by a wide and variegated gulf, and very far away from the man who, shortly after he became my father, would take me for rides upon his shoulders to buy ice cream at the drugstore, to see the baseball games I did not understand, or into the open fields to pat the pit horses and be placed upon their broad and gentle backs. As we would approach the horses, he would speak softly to them so that they might know where we were and be unafraid when he finally placed his hand upon them, for all of them were blind. They had been so long in the darkness of the mine that their eyes did not know the light, and the darkness of their labor had become that of their lives.
That's the voice of Alistair MacLeod reading one of his short stories from the recently released collection called Island. And Alistair, when I listen to you talk and I listen to you read, I don't hear much of a difference. I'm wondering, when you prepare your stories, do you say them out loud? Do you rely on what sounds good in the ear?
Yes, I do. I always read them aloud, and I like to believe that storytelling is older than literacy, so I like to pretend that I'm kind of recounting these stories orally, although I know that's a conceit. But I read each sentence aloud to myself, and I've always believed that the ear is a good editor, or I like to think that my ear is a good editor for me. And so I do read them aloud, and I like to pretend that I'm sort of telling them rather than reading them.
It took you 13 years, if I'm not mistaken, to write No Great Mischief. Is that correct?
Well, it didn't take me 13 years, like 8 hours a day or anything like that. But Over a period of 13 years. I would work on this novel mainly during the summers, and then I would set it aside in September, and sometimes I'd pick it up again at Christmas or not. In some cases, until the next summer, and then I would read over what I had written a year ago with some wonder, and then I would go forward again. But I was thinking of it nearly all of the time, so when I wasn't actually writing it, I was thinking of things that I might say and making little mental notes to myself. So I'm kind of embarrassed when people say, you know, this is all you have to show for 13 years. But on the other hand, when people say, well, you know, you did this for 13 years and it's really good, then I sort of perk up and feel cheery about it. But I wasn't working at it, you know, every single day for 13 years. I may be slow, but I'm not quite that slow.
Not if you can make it to Cape Breton in 2.5 days by car.
No, well, that's a different activity, yes.
I do want a little more insight into the process, though, because this connection between making it work in your ear, does that mean that you have the sentence orally in your head before you put it on paper?
Well, very often I do, or I write it down, and then I read it aloud to myself. And sometimes, it sounds just great, and then I say, oh, I will keep this. And then sometimes it seems to, you know, not scan, as one might say in poetry, as pleasantly as I would like it to. And so then I tinker around with it and hope that it'll be satisfying to myself and to my readers. I think all writers are like that, you know, they hope, they have to kind of satisfy their own critical tastes first, and then they hope that what works for them will also work for the reader. So that's the way that I work.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection with Alistair MacLeod on National Public Radio, and Jill is on the line. Hi, Jill.
Hi there.
Hello.
Do you have a question, Jill?
Yes, I do. But I would like to say that I just finished reading No Great Mischief and really enjoyed it. My book group just discussed it last night, and so this was perfect timing. I think you should be proud of having written this, and it doesn't matter if it took you 13 years to do this.
Thank you very much. You're the kind of listener that I really, really appreciate.
Well, then I hope you won't mind a couple of very pedestrian questions.
I won't mind at all.
Great. Would you favor us with a correct pronunciation of the Gaelic expression you use for the little red-haired boy?
Oh, all right. Gilly Beck Rua. Gilly means boy, and Beck means little, and Rua means red. Red-haired boy. Yeah.
Huh. Okay. That's nice.
It's not even close to the way that it's spelled in the book, is it?
No, but that's just languages are like that. I keep saying, when you look at the word phone, a lot of people might want to pronounce it pahoney or something like that. But once you figure out that PH very often sounds like F, well, then it helps.
Thank you.
Question two, Jill.
Yes?
Did you have another question for Mr. MacLeod?
One very silly one, yes. One thing that confused all of us is that the American cousin, not the American cousin, the cousin that had the mining accident, it was always referred to as the red-haired Alexander MacDonald.
Yes.
But it seemed to me that would describe the narrator as well. Wasn't he also? He was, of course, red-haired. And so we wondered why the other one was always referred to as the red-haired Alexander MacDonald.
Well, there's lots of Alexander lots of Alexander MacDonalds in the novel. And I think that he's just trying to make a distinction, and it's not much of a distinction,
No. Because
the novel is sort of about, you know, people who look the same and have the same names and therefore are perceived as being very much the same. But they're really not that much the same. The American Alexander MacDonald and the orthodontist Alexander MacDonald and the red-haired Alexander MacDonald may all have the same name, and they may be able to exchange, you know, their identification cards or their driver's licenses and so on. But still they are quite distinct in their own personalities.
Yes, very different people.
Jill, thank you very much for joining us. We've got a few other callers on the line I'd like to move along. Charles is joining The Connection. Hello, Charles.
Hi. Mr. MacLeod, I have an experience that is right out of Dante that I can only say comes from Cape Breton Island, Glace Bay, the Miners Museum. I got locked in there at about 4 in the afternoon on a day after Labor Day about a half a decade ago. And I was trying different doors to find a way to get out. I came to one door and there was a wind blowing through the crack. And I said, this is no ordinary wind that blows on Earth. This comes from somewhere else. I burst open the door and was in a room in the museum, and there in front of me was the thing that most fascinated and most terrified me in one object, a gigantic opening leading down under the earth at about a 30-degree slope. and it was called Ocean Something Mine, 1967. Mm-hmm. And I realized it led down into a mine that went about 18 miles under the ocean.
That's
correct.
And this
wind was coming up, and it was like Dante. And I felt I wanted to go down there, and I was scared to death. And I thought, where else in the world could I have an experience like that?
Nowhere else in the world.
So I wanted to just share that with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Most of those mines are closed now, aren't they, Alistair?
Yes, they are. Yes.
Has that done much to change the character of Cape Breton Island in that you don't have people actively working in the mines but talking about the time that they did?
Yes. Well, the most recent closings are just kind of within the past year.
Right.
And so this causes great hardship because it's a lack of industry and it's a lack of work for people. And, although not everybody may want to work in a mine, if you grow up doing that and, it's your family's employment, you would like the mine to keep going because you would like to stay in your community and continue to work there. So it means a great deal of sadness and, dislocation on a daily basis. And, people are worried about their futures and so on. Like whenever an industry closes down in a more or less single industry community, it wreaks great havoc.
Our telephone number at The Connection is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And Christine from Providence, Rhode Island, you're part of The Connection.
Hi, Alistair. I have to say quickly that my mother's from Inverness and my father from Kenloch. And
oh, okay.
I was reading No Great Mischief when I was home last summer, and I saw you in Broad Cove, but was too shy to go over and say, oh, I love your book.
No, well, thank you very much.
But what I was thought I'd ask you about is one of the things I thought was remarkable about your novel was its universalness or universality. It seemed like even though it was about this very tiny little culture that I could relate to, it seemed like the book was so accessible to anybody, and particularly when the miners found commonness in their experience with the French miners.
Yeah.
or the ones at many part of the country or part of the world. One thing I was also struck about was that you didn't seem to mention religion or church in the book very much, which, is a part of Cape Breton. And I was wondering whether that was on purpose because you thought it would make it less universal or that's just the way it came about.
Well, in response to the first question, I believe that if you write about any place, carefully enough, it will make it accessible to the larger world. So I'm very, very pleased that this book, which is set in Cape Breton and set in Canada, has been bought by the Italians and the French and the Israelis and the Japanese and on, because this means that, as you said earlier, that it is accessible to others, and I'm very pleased about that. As far as the religious issue, I don't know if it's an issue, as far as religion is concerned, I wanted the book to be, just about people.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt if I started introducing, any kind of religion, it would exclude perhaps people who weren't of that religion.
Mm-hmm.
So although I think the people in the book, I hope, are quite spiritual, I didn't want to sort of make them all Baptists or all Catholics all United Church or whatever, because I thought, as I said before, it would make them less universal than I wish them to be.
Yeah, I think you were very successful in that, in showing their spirituality through, and that just struck me. I wondered whether you did that consciously or not. But
I think so.
Yeah.
Christine, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Alistair.
Christine, if you see me this summer, make yourself known.
I will.
You're probably my relative.
That's right.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
You're welcome.
I'm curious to know, just thinking about what Christine was saying, Alistair, whether or not you get feedback from your readers which surprises you, letters or people approaching you with notions about what they've read that which you hadn't anticipated or, as I said, surprise you.
Yeah, sometimes they do. Like, there are all kinds of people out there, with their own interests and so on. And one woman said to me, you know, I really like this book because there was so much food in it. And I was thinking, gee, I don't think there's much food in it. But, but what she was interested in was kind of like women's work in a earlier time, you know, where women were very much engaged in preparing food for menfolk. And it was kind of, you know, a time where there was, what shall we say, a kind of sexual difference in a division of labor and mm-hmm. so on. So when she mentioned that, I was kind of surprised, but she was accurate. The other thing that I hear a lot is a lot of, I don't know if I just say men, but there are a lot of men who work with their hands, who do physical work, and they never see their lives kind of discussed or described very much in novels. And so sometimes I get letters from them, and then sometimes I get letters from their daughters or people who say things like, you know, my father only read one book in his life, and it's this book, because physical labor is something that you don't see very often, you know, as a, I don't know, as a sort of worthy subject for literature. So things of that nature come along. Plus, you know, a lot of people who have strong families and are very interested in that, or people who have no families and wish they had strong families, or people who are trying to get away from their families and get back to their families or whatever. So those issues kind of, you know, crop up from time to time. So I'm glad all these people find, you know, such a, you know, vast variety of subjects within the novel, because that must mean that I put them there.
Yeah, like the question, did they get there by accident or did you put it there?
No, I put them there. Alistair, I'm always pleased.
Alistair MacLeod is my guest. Our telephone number on The Connection, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. Our telephone number to talk with the writer Alistair MacLeod is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Tom is on the line. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Do you have a question or something you'd like to talk about?
Yes, I have a couple of questions for Alistair MacLeod. The first one involves, I'm curious about his use of real history in the background of the novel. The bloody Battle of Culloden in Scotland, and also the Battle of the Plains of Abraham in Quebec. And my question is kind of double-barreled. I'm wondering if there is a folk memory of those battles in Cape Breton, or if this is primarily a literary construction that he brings to the novel as a way of revising how we think about history as being usually involving larger-than-life figures like generals, Montcalm and Wolfe. So that's my first question. It involves, how does that history really play to the thematic interest of the novel?
Well, the battles and so on are all, you know, historically accurate. And I think that one of the things that I've always been interested in is when battles are described, they're nearly always told from the point of view of the victors. Those who are vanquished hardly ever get to tell their view of history. And I think at Culloden, a lot of the people who lost the battle, shall we say, were Gaelic-speaking people, and the MacDonalds were very prominent there and so on. So, you know, that's historically accurate. The dating of the battle and so on is historically accurate. As far as the Wolfe and Montcalm and the Plains of Abraham are concerned, what I was interested there in there was like Wolfe's description of the Highlanders, because he had fought against these people in 1745, and then 15 years later they were fighting under his command. the siege of Quebec. So somebody who would be 20 at Culloden would be like 35 at the Plains of Abraham. And he really did that, write that letter. That's an historically accurate letter. And, you know, what he's saying is that these are good, tough soldiers, and we'll put them in the front lines. And if they get shot, no great mischief if they fall. So one of the sub-themes, I suppose, in the novel is, you know, that issue of always doing what you're told, or, you know, obeying your commander, and, you know, the good news and the bad news that may result from such actions. So what I was doing was, like, doing, placing fictional characters in the pages, I suppose, of true history.
But as the people who sit around the stoves and around the table slopped with beer, does their own folk history, the stories of the grandfathers and the great-great-grandfathers, actually go far back enough to include those?
It would vary, I think, from house to house, you know, and it would vary from individual to individual. Like in the novel, I have the one serious grandfather who is very, very much caught up in, you know, the history of Culloden and so on, and keeps telling this to anyone who will listen, because that's his particular interest. Parallel to him, or perhaps opposed to him, is the other grandfather who spends all the time, you know, drinking beer and clicking his heels and so on. And he's not very interested at all, although, you know, some of it washes over him, let's say. So I just wanted to sort of present two men, perhaps in their 70s, who are of the same genetic makeup, who have kind of different interests in their past.
Tom, I interrupted you. You had a second quick question?
Yes, I have a second question. I'm wondering, Alistair, where your literary license derives from. I think you would agree with me that Cape Breton does not have a long and deep literary tradition, that they've got an oral tradition and so on. Hugh MacLennan comes to mind as perhaps the first writer that people might associate with Cape Breton. And I've been reading your stories for about a dozen years, I suppose, maybe 15 years.
Good for you.
So I'm familiar with your work going back quite a distance. But I'm wondering if in a way you had to license yourself to find in that ordinary life the material of enduring literature, or is there some writer or group of writers that you felt licensed by?
No, I don't think I felt licensed by anybody. I just always liked literature, and I like to read and so on. And I studied literature quite seriously, you know, like I went away to get a PhD in it and so on. And when you get a PhD in literature, what you do is analyze a lot of stories. So I did that for a while, and then I began to think, well, you know, instead of just analyzing other people's stories, maybe I should try to write my own stories. Like, why not, you know? So I just went forth and tried to do it. And I'm glad that I did.
Tom, thank you very much for your call. As I'm listening to you talk about your decision to try and write, I'm thinking about this what we were discussing earlier, Alistair, and that's the oral tradition that you're putting down on paper. Can we squeak one more reading into this hour? There's that point in No Great Mischief when, if I'm mistaken, the narrator's mother and father and brother have all died by falling through the ice.
That's correct.
And then you pick up the story with the dog, but help me a little bit, set the scene a little bit better than I have.
Well, this family that went through the ice were lighthouse keepers on an island. And the dog is with them when they go through the ice, but the dog is saved. And she thinks that the people will still be on the island doing whatever they did. And she goes from the mainland back to the island to be with her people. Twice before the breakup, the dog left my grandparents' house and crossed to the island looking for her people. And twice my uncles crossed to bring her back. The second time, Grandpa tied her with a chain to the doorstep, but she whined or whinged, as they said, so visibly and so mournfully, that the next morning Grandpa let her go. "Because she was breaking my heart," he said. Immediately she raced down to the shore and started to cross, running low across the level ice and hurling herself without hesitation into the open water, swimming to the nearest pan and then leaping from one pan to the other while Grandpa watched her progress through his binoculars. "She made it," he said, finally, turning from the window. "Poor coup." She was still there, waiting for her vanished people to rise out of the sea, when the new lightkeeper, a man from the Way of Picto, nudged the prow of his boat against the wharf on the island's rocky shore. She came scrambling down the rocks to meet him, with her hackles raised and her teeth bared, protecting what she thought was hers and snarling in her certainty. And he reached into the prow of his boat for his .22 rifle and pumped four bullets into her loyal waiting heart. And later he caught her by the hind legs and threw her body into the sea. "She was descended from the original Kalamrua dog," said Grandpa, when he heard the news, pouring himself a water glass full of whiskey, which he drank without a flinch. "The one who swam after the boat when they were leaving Scotland. It was in those dogs to care too much and to try too hard."
That's Alistair MacLeod reading from No Great Mischief. And Alistair, as I listen to you read that particular passage of pretty nasty piece of narrative in a very understated way, I was thinking about the similarity that exists in that kind of storytelling style, which comes south of the Nova Scotia border and down the main coast to into New England. It's a storytelling style which I think spans both borders. Does it not?
I think so. Yes, I think that. You know, perhaps people along the New England coast and perhaps people along the, you know, the Cape Breton coast and the Eastern Canadian coast, they do share that landscape. And that's one aspect of similarity. And I think another aspect of similarity is that they have been there like a long, long time. And perhaps in, you know, outparts of Maine and outparts of Newfoundland, people have not been part of the larger North American melting pot, as they might have become had they spent a lot of their time in Houston or New York or Toronto or in the larger cities.
Marguerite, you're part of the connection. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, we hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. What I'd like to make a comment on is that I have for years been going down to Marguerite and sometimes into Gillisville. Where there is
Gillisdale,
yes,
right.
I'm sorry, where there is such joy and such cooperation among the farmers. I've always said they were rich in everything but money.
Well, I think that's probably quite an accurate statement.
And the violins would go and the girls would play the pump organ and I would dance and the evening would go on and on. And another comment Jack Gillis made was, when we come to see you, you have never any time for us.
Well,
when you come up here, everything stops and we have a great time. And so in spite of all of the, it just seems to me, all of the tragedy that I know is there, there's also something that perhaps we don't have.
Well, yes, I think you're probably quite accurate. It's very hard, you know, to sort of say, well, whenever one does this, he or she trades in everything for something else. I think it's all sort of a game of
yeah.
I wouldn't say a game of inches, but, if you're going to be very prosperous and work hard in the modern world, maybe you don't have time to spend with your friends or your relatives or not as much as you would like. And then there's on the other side, perhaps people who have too much time and not enough material wherewithal. So I think there's a kind of, I wouldn't say a tension, but a kind of uneasy combination of how we might live our lives.
And you pointed this nicely out in the story about the lawyer who came from Toronto.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he's leading a lawyer's life in a big city, and he comes back to a place where nobody is leading a lawyer's life in a big city. And, excuse me, it's different, and he's kind of part of both worlds.
But there was a tremendous amount of love and companionship in that little town.
Sure there was.
Marguerite, thank you very much. We have to move along. I wanted to pick up on one aspect of Marguerite's call before we say goodbye, though, Alistair, and that is the are there not now more people coming to Cape Breton than ever before? You may be part of the guilt a guilty party for this, but you know, Americans. I've heard Cape Breton Island people complain about Americans buying land up there, Germans, that sort of thing. Is that a serious factor in changing the island?
Oh, I don't know if it's a serious factor, but it is true that you know, as some people are leaving Cape Breton, they're meeting other people going to Cape Breton, and I don't know, maybe the sad reality is very often those who are leaving are people who do not have money, and those who are going in to buy land are people who do have money, and I think that does change things to a certain extent. Although there are a lot of people from, you know, the Boston area who have been there now for generations and are very well integrated and very well accepted and, you know, part of the general community.
Now, you're heading back there tomorrow. You're going to take a little chance to rest a bit?
Well, we'll see, yes. It's a 1,500-mile drive. So.
No, but I mean once you get there.
Well, we'll see, yes. I hope so.
And what are you, about 5 or 6 years into the next novel?
Oh, yes. Well, I'm just going to write one every 60 years, so I have lots of time. See, I've published one when I'm 60 and one when I'm 120, so I'll be all set.
Alistair MacLeod, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Alistair MacLeod, the author of No Great Mischief, available in paperback and island, out in hardcover. We had help today on The Connection from Kim Bichari and Darren Manoogian and Tim Monroe. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Rousseau, Doug Sugertz, and Ben Walker. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. To continue the conversation, you can go to our website, theconnection.org. You can also find more information online about the Cape Breton musicians that we've been hearing during the program. My name is Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is double.